New York Times games make me feel like I'm amazing.
Wordle makes me feel things that I don't feel from anyone else.
I absolutely love Spelling Bee.
The Times crossword puzzle is a companion that I've had longer than anyone outside of my immediate family.
When I can finish a hard puzzle without hints, I feel like the smartest person in the world.
It gives me joy every single day.
Join us and play all New York Times games
at nytimes.com/games.
Subscribe by March 16th to get a special offer.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your yuck, yuck goose of news, news, and criticism. I'm John Caramonica, critic of the New York Times.
And I'm Joe Coscarelli. I'm a reporter at the New York Times.
Joe, we are recording this the day after the Oscars. A huge night for Anora, a huge night for Tattoo. All the things she said being played at the opening of this episode. A very important song in 2008? Nine, something in there. Did I ever tell you about the dinner that I had with Tatu at the restaurant that's like underneath the Queensboro Bridge?
This is the plot of the next Sean Baker movie.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it was like, you know, back when press dinners were still worth going to. Yeah. Had a dinner with Tatu. Lovely conversation with one of the two members of Tatu that evening. Joe, what do you make? We're going to talk, first of all, this episode is going to be largely focused on music and music adjacent things at the Oscars.
Of which there was so many.
Shocking.
It was basically the Grammys.
Yeah, again. A shocking amount in both highs and lows of music at the Oscars.
Yes.
But let's start with the big scenario, which is Anora wins, which is a huge win for Russian language industrial rap music, for Tatu.
Brooke Candy?
Brooke Candy. Slater?
Mm-hmm.
For early 2010s strip club hip hop type beats. If you look at the
Let me just do a little foray here into the music choices of Anora in the club specifically. I get this is an independent film. Maybe the music budget wasn't at P-Valley levels or whatever
shout
it may
out P-Valley. Be. Shout out Ian, podcast listener, one of the writers on P-Valley.
But DMX's Where the Hood At, who plays in this movie. That was the thing that took me out of this movie more than anything except Mikey Madison's accent, her Outerboro accent, which, bless her, the surprise win of the night, best actress, taking it over Demi Moore, Better Things Hive, stand up. We've loved Mikey for a long time. She's amazing in the Scream franchise. She's amazing in Anora. The accent didn't work for me. Neither did DMX's Where the Hood At being played in that club. It's like the one actual rap song in the movie, like the most like straight ahead New York rap song in the movie, but just not a club song.
I will say it didn't quite take me out as much as that one scene in, I think it's season one of The Wire, where they're playing Mos Def. Like that, it wasn't that bad. I would imagine DMX records abstractly being played in those circumstances. That one, who can say? Huge night, though, for Anora. Big night for independent cinema. And again, big night for strip club type beats in those scenes. Did you feel that the Anora victory was earned?
I am a big Sean Baker fan. I love his movies. I liked this one. I didn't think it was his best. I think the last couple, Red Rocket, Florida Project, even Tangerine, are like stronger as movies. And I never quite bought that this was an Oscars movie, but I guess just nobody knows what an Oscars movie is anymore. And that's fine. I think like it made for a really fun telecast.
Kind of like unpredictable. The highs feel really unpredictable because it does seem that there's this tension. Is a Hollywood movie just as the butt of the joke is? Is it just Joker 2? Is it just some Marvel movie? And then Oscars people are like, certainly we can't nominate those films. And there's literally no middle class of film left. So all that's left is the others. Is this things like this?
Yeah. Although like, you know, Conclave or Complete Unknown, the Bob Dylan biopic, like either of those movies would have felt more like quote unquote Oscar movies, I think. Like Anora's frontrunner status never felt secure. But it gave us some good moments. And it was interesting to watch the Anora storylines, Sean Baker himself winning 4 awards, Mikey Madison winning hers, and that being threaded with the sort of big Hollywood LA stuff. We'll get to this, but the Quincy Jones tribute, the James Bond stuff, the Wizard of Oz / Wicked stuff, like all of that is of a certain palette. And then Anora is just a huge swerve.
You have me thinking about what the Anora tribute is going to look like 25 years from now.
Yeah, it's going to be Brooke Candy and yeah. Slater doing the rounds that Ray and Doja Cat and Lisa did.
Doja Cat, singer of the night, question mark? I would say yes.
Worst singer of the night?
Hey, I thought she did great.
Okay, all right. I'm excited to argue about this as we get deeper into those segments. But first, you saw Anora. How many of these movies did you see? You don't actually have to say it. We're here to talk about the music of the Oscars because we didn't go all out on the Oscars this year. A, have you ever watched the Oscars before, front to back? And B, did you see Anora?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And I quite enjoyed Anora, and also just a moment of personal pride filmed in the neighborhoods of my childhood.
And that made you endeared to it, not put off by it?
Not at all. I grew up in Sheepshead Bay, which is adjacent to Brighton Beach. And then the mansion in that film is in Mill Basin, which is where I spent my teenage years.
Right.
And I randomly was talking to Sam Sifton, our colleague, about this in the office a couple of weeks ago. It's like, when I was growing up there, it's like you were not encouraged to think of those places as artful places or places where something beautiful might happen. Certainly not in a way that could translate to an Oscars campaign or even an Oscars victory. So there's something softly redeeming about this. I often drive back to my old neighborhood because I do think the gaudiness has appeal. That's the kind of interior design I like. That's the kind of architecture I gravitate towards. Like, I do see actual tangible beauty in those things, but I rarely see them lovingly displayed. I sometimes see them ironically displayed, or I see them like flatly, blankly displayed. But to see them displayed with some kind of affection and lusciousness, and also a nod to like the narrative power underneath those kinds of places, I did find genuinely moving.
And everything you said applies to my life and Florida Project.
So, I believe.
You know, I think we're aligned in that sense.
Sean Baker, a man for us. So Sean Baker, come on Popcast to talk about our childhoods.
Anytime.
If Sean Baker does come on Popcast, like, it's literally just going to be therapy for me and you specifically.
Yeah.
It's going to be great. Beyond Anora, maybe not as much an Oscars for John, but there were, I saw Wicked, obviously.
Right. We've talked about Wicked. We've talked about A Complete Unknown.
I'm now, maybe we'll finally see Brutalist, if only for Daniel Blumberg's score. Shout out Yuck. I had not known that the former frontman of Yuck was now an esteemed composer of film scores, but I'm extremely excited to know that. You want to talk about Wicked?
Yeah, let's talk about that opening number.
An opener. Here's the thing. Two exceptional singers who I believe are in a protracted personal war with each other under the cover of forced social media intimacy and like press tour intimacy. And I felt like maybe we don't always see the tension between Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande in mm-hmm. these kind of viral moments.
They gave us the shot. They gave us yes. the shot we've been waiting for.
I felt it. And I was so unprepared because it comes right at the beginning of the show. And you're immediately asked to cast aside the propaganda that we've been served for months and months. I felt the raw friction. Did you also felt it?
We started with Over the Rainbow, Ariana solo. And that was after the LA montage. It was moving. It reminded me that Over the Rainbow is better than any song in Wicked, including Defying Gravity, which is an amazing song, but it's not Over the Rainbow.
The second half of it is amazing.
Yeah. And then you shift to Cynthia Erivo performing Home from The Wiz, the Dana Ross solo song. And then you get them joining forces for Defying Gravity, or parts of it. And as it's starting to reach its climax, in which Cynthia Erivo is going to do the run, those crazy notes, you get that foreground, background shot of Ariana and Cynthia going back and forth. And yeah, that was very much, oh, also remember these two are competing, dare I say?
Yeah, so it's interesting. Like, you got to wonder what the negotiations were for this, right? Because on the one hand, Ariana goes first. Perhaps you can argue that Ariana is the more famous writ large of the two. However, even though Ariana is a great singer, Cynthia Erivo is potentially a great plus singer.
Yes.
So then you have to somehow orient the performance around Cynthia Erivo. And then the third section where Cynthia is really going for it from the film that receives all the nominations, it's not only the shot where Ariana's off to the side and soft focus, it's you almost, if I remember correctly, they filmed her almost like scurrying away from Cynthia Erivo. That I feel like
before
I saw,
the note hits,
before the note hits,
for
yes,
cover.
To get to the other mark on the stage. And in that moment, I felt like the entire fallacy that we've been served for the last multiple months, I felt it all collapse, because it just felt like this is the product of managers and lawyers negotiating how many feet away a person could be, where the cameras are going to be, et cetera, et cetera. It did not feel warm and genuine and shared to me. I'm not saying I didn't like it. I liked it.
And we only have 2 more years of this to go.
Every Oscars for the next two more years will begin with some kind of psycho-spiritual tug of war between Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande. Honestly, fine. What else would be better? To me, that was the standout musical performance of the night, I think, to the extent that there weren't loads of musical performances, but to me, that was the standout.
Oh, yeah, easily. And I do want to talk about some of the more disappointing ones, but while we're talking about disappointments, like, I do think it's worth noting that Ariana Grande should have won an Oscar, I think. And Zoe Saldana should not. Emilia Perez got, let's say, marginalized.
Again, I've taken your word about the quality issues in Emilia Perez. Although, again, every time something absurd happens in and around that movie, it does make me feel like I need to at least absorb it to understand all the mayhem, to really like be a piece, to be one with the mayhem.
Yes. Even the clip that they showed it leading up to the nominations, Zoe Saldana has her number and Ariana Grande has her number that get put up on screen. And like, it's just baffling that you could compare the two directly and then land on the side that the voters landed on. I just, that Zoe Saldana performance is baffling in every way, and especially the musical components. I was watching with a friend who also felt very strongly that Ariana should have won, which I don't think most people gave her a chance if you were following the race and the way the previous award shows had gone. But she was imagining when my one-year-old daughter as a teenager showing her clips from both movies and being like, can you believe this, in the way that like I might do to
Crash.
Remind Yeah, or to remind people that Cate Blanchett didn't win Best Actress for Tar, that kind of thing. But, okay, I have to ask, as somebody who has not done the full Emilia Perez experience,
yeah,
when you saw El Mal, one of the songs, win Best Original Song, and you're just catching little glimpses of what this movie was and what these songs were, could you wrap your mind around what was going on there? 2 Emilia Perez songs were in those categories, the Selena Gomez one and the Zoe Saldana one.
This is, again, I want to preface this by saying that this is a medium informed take, because I've absorbed pieces of this concert. So no, I want to be clear about that. Do you watch Eurovision?
Not in its entirety.
Okay, I do not watch Eurovision, but I absorb a fair amount of Eurovision material. And same. There is something about that particular European conception of popular music where it's pungent, but also kitsch. And often the kitsch outstrips the kind of technique. It's like, often I'll listen to Eurovision songs and I'll be like, there's accomplished things happening here within this song, but the sense of, I don't even want to call it humor because I'm not sure it's funny, but it is kitschy. And that sense of, we are engaged in a theatrical practice that happens to be built upon the bones of a pop music production. That energy is what I feel coming off of those Emilia Perez songs. Now, again, I don't know I can't speak to the entire thing. Maybe it, the film, to the extent that the film worked at all, maybe it doesn't work if the pop songs are good pop songs. Like, maybe it needs to be theatrically kitsch in order for the, I again, speculating, but my takeaway is I felt a lot of Eurovision in those songs. And I know we're going to get emails about this, but that's not a compliment.
No, big Eurovision energy, for sure. That part is accurate. The idea that these songs somehow needed to be bad for the movie to work is just could not be further from the truth. Okay. Overall, I just have to say, these are some of the most confounding, atonal, arrhythmic, just some of the most awful music I've ever heard in my life. And if there was like...
I can't wait to love it.
Three, I know. But if there were like two or three bangers... If there were bangers or even like a couple hooks, like then maybe the movie is like a touch more enjoyable. But El Mal, specifically the song that ended up winning, is basically like rap rock reggaeton. It's like punishing to listen to.
Tell me more. Are you saying Warped Tour 2027? Is that what that's going to be influencing?
But written by French people. And look, I think you can go along with all of it and be like, okay, I'm here for the camp. They're trying something. It is certainly formally audacious in every way. But when the three of them were up there giving their speech and then attempted to lead a sing-along of a separate song from the movie, first of all, as off-key as...
Do you think it was a
Doja
sing-along?
Cat. I think they were trying to cue a sing-along, and then they're getting played off. It was
that's
like,
actually way crazier. If it was an attempted sing-along, that's actually way crazier. I didn't read it that way at all, because I was like, nobody knows what this is. Like, how could it be anything other than these individuals on their own vision quest?
But she was gesturing to the audience in a join me way.
Oh, I just took that in that like European way of we're all having late dinner together. Come to the table. It's 11 o'clock. I guess I didn't read it that way.
But then they're getting played off. It was just like full body shivers at the secondhand embarrassment that this person was putting into the world.
I don't think that person was embarrassed. Just I mean, for look, the record.
They won an Oscar.
No. And also, look, if anything, it is proof that you can create secondhand embarrassment without firsthand embarrassment.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
Those people were not embarrassed. Those people are going to have a lot, like we're going to be dealing with those people for a long time. Regrettably.
No, I know. And the fact that they were putting the onus of the embarrassment onto me and the audience, that was really tough. And I gotta say, it's a feeling, not to that extent, but it's a feeling I had a couple other times during the show, mostly in the Doja Cat section of that very long, seemingly random James Bond tribute, which maybe was a commercial for the changing hands of the IP to Amazon.
Right. I actually thought at the end of the dance routine with Margaret Qualley. Why? Is there a thing? Is Margaret Qualley the new Bond?
One of the dudes from the Eras Tour was there too.
Apparently five. Apparently there were five Eras Tour dancers. Like Taylor Twitter has identified five Eras Tour dancers. Okay.
Jack and Margaret got it done. No, but I thought that too. I was like, oh, they're announcing Margaret Qualley as the lead Bond girl here for the next film. And then maybe the performance is going to end with a reveal of
Idris Elba coming out.
Or Harry Dickinson as James Bond, whatever it is. Instead, we got Ray making a direct comparison between herself and Adele, which does nobody any favors. But that went on so long, and Doja Cat was in the middle doing Diamonds Are Forever. Was she not a little pitchy?
It didn't bother me. Look,
stage?
Doja Cat, here's the thing. Look, all right, so we'll start with Lisa, then we have Doja Cat, then we have Ray. And let's just talk like from step back, what is the relationship of these individuals to like the source material or like the attitude of the source material? Lisa, I like Lisa. It feels a little gratuitous. It feels a little bit like we're shoehorning this person in a play set and maybe is not consistent with her musical output.
Or nor is Live or Let Die have anything to do with what we've heard from Lisa.
No, not at all. If anything, I would even say that the vocal tone that I was hearing on that song, I was like, I'm not even 100% convinced that this is the vocal tone that I'm hearing on other Lisa music. We'll come back to that in another episode. Then let's skip over Doja for a second. Ray would seem to be a singer who is laboratory made to do Bond theme songs, right? Like British soul singer, has the ability to pipe, really approaches performing with a kind of restrained regalness. To me, this was nowhere near Ray's Grammy performance. I thought the part of it that was good, where it really takes off, took way too long to get to. And also, I will say, following Doja Cat, who I agree had an imperfect performance, but the growl, the kind of I'm here for a reason. And also the thing about Doja, it's like people who think she can rap forget she can sing. People who think she can sing forget she can rap. People who think of her as a pop star don't think of her as an artiste at all. And I think what she was channeling, 70s soul singing, I think the physicality of that performance outweighed the vocal missteps here and there. You're not riding for it. You're just like, you're off it.
I will say I was more tuned in during that middle segment, that Diamonds Are Forever That's rendition.
She held it. She held it.
She did hold the screen.
Our
and she
only
did it.
Legitimate pop star.
Yes. She did it with less accoutrement than everybody around her, the people before and after her. I'll give it up to Doja Cat for doing something like that. I agree it's out of her comfort zone, at least in terms of how most people know or think of her. It was a big look. I'd say a big look for all of them, for three people who are famous, very famous in their worlds, but not Ariana Grande.
But also bizarre. Who, it's not, this isn't Billie Eilish doing a Bond theme song, and you're like, Billie Eilish is incredibly famous. Of course Billie Eilish would perform a Bond theme song. It's in what room was it determined that, like, you know who really is going to nail the Bond music tribute? Who did this? Do you listen to Popcast? If you do, email us. We want to hear from you because we are absolutely confused. There was nothing organic about it. Even the moment at the end where they all finally stood together, I was like, nobody coached y'all on how to stand with each other. There's no, you could have done a Charlie's Angels thing. You could have done it absolutely felt neither, none of the three had ever spoken to any of the other of the three prior to that moment. It was awkward and also, to your point, overlong. Like, why, what, to what? And with absolutely no payoff.
And the reason that really stood out to me was because then when you get to the Quincy Jones tribute, you're expecting something of at least equal length and value, if not twice as big, twice as long, twice as loaded. And so when Queen Latifah's doing Ease On Down the Road, again from The Wiz, Diana Michael number, and I kept being like, all right, who's coming out to join her? Or like, when's the set going to change? And who's going to do the next part? Like, when are we going to really go all out for Quincy? And then it just petered out. And I was like, they not only left Quincy Jones out to dry, but they left Queen Latifah out to dry because that performance just felt like an afterthought, especially when compared to the Bond one, which had 10 times the production value, weirdly.
And also only three people were dancing to the Queen Latifah. It was Coleman Domingo, literally perhaps the best human on the planet, and then Ariana and Cynthia in their seats or in their separate seats. Just an absolutely baffling thing. We're going to be back in a minute, but I want to leave people with some inspiration. I feel like we're down talking a lot, but let's leave people with some inspiration. You know what that means. It's time for some yuck. It's Suicide Policeman. Take a listen to this and we'll be right back.
This is Somini Sengupta. I'm a reporter for The New York Times. I've covered 9 conflicts, written about earthquakes, terror attacks, droughts, floods, many humanitarian crises. My job is to bear witness. Right now, I'm writing about climate change, And I'm trying to answer some really big and urgent questions about life on a hotter planet. Like, who is most vulnerable to climate change? Should we redesign our cities? Should we be eating differently? What happens to the millions of people who live by the coast as the oceans rise? To make sense of this, I talk to climate scientists, inventors, activists. Mostly, I document the impact of global warming. And that impact is highly, highly unequal. My colleagues and I are doing our best to answer complicated questions like these, but we can't do that without our subscribers. If you'd like to subscribe, go to nytimes.com/subscribe. And thank you.
We are back. It's Popcast. I'm here with Joe. We're talking about music at the Oscars. And when the best score winner was announced and that gentleman shuffled onto stage in his unusually fitting, slightly shiny black suit, talked about making independent music for a very long time. I was like, why? That's what this guy seems slightly familiar to me. I couldn't place it. And I Googled the name. And boy, was I excited, because Daniel Blumberg, who created the score for The Brutalist, was the frontman of Yuck, which was an incredible band at the turn of the 2010s, doing pretty spot on 90s indie retro. At least one great album, one great EP. Was there a second album? I'm not entirely sure. I never heard it if there was. I think it was just the one.
That's what you need from a band like that, though.
Go away.
One album, some live shows.
Get out of here.
Yeah.
I dug up my review of their Bowery Ballroom debut back when I was covering shows extensively. A great night to my memory, a great show, a great band. I posted it. So many people responded about how much they love Yuck. They love Yuck. Yuck is beloved. Daniel Blumberg apparently has moved on, is making music like this. And for me, I'm excited that a person like that who seem to be able to recreate sounds at will. This is the other thing. It's like the Yuck EP, if I remember correctly, is like, it's quite different from the Yuck album, but they're both very targeted. They're very specific and well executed. Apparently, that's a skill that comes in really handy in film scoring. What do you make of the score of The Brutalist?
I've heard great things. I have not seen the film yet. It's really hard.
Oh, I didn't realize we were both.
Yes. Really hard to get away for the length of an Oscar ceremony, but in a theater. Side note, I thought that the little digital short they did where they reinvent the movie theater as a tech product called Cinema Streams, I thought that was really strong. That was good, as were many of the Conan jokes.
A funny person with funny writers.
Yeah, I want to talk about the Drake one in a second, the brief Drake one-liner. But no, the Blumberg score, much beloved, what I've heard of it, sounds great. I really want to see it in context. I will be going this week, maybe before this episode even airs. But I will say, just his presence and the way that everyone was immediately, both IRL and online, like thirsting over this British semi-goth, almost made up for the Trent Reznor, Atticus Ross snub for the Challenger soundtrack, which was actually the best original score.
Yeah.
But going from 90s rock to beloved scorer of film, I think Trent would have been nodding his head happily at home at the sight of Daniel Blumberg.
Yeah, again, we'll save this for our friends over at The Big Picture to talk about like independent film renaissance that this may or may not imply. But I did find it encouraging to think that this guy probably made that score for like $25 and a Chick-fil-A gift card and probably had to like scramble to get a suit. I don't know what designer, if a designer was dressing Daniel Blumberg last night.
Are we up on Cafe Otto, the art space he was shouting out from London?
No. Once I Googled, I was like, okay, I know what that is, but like it did not immediately register for me. Did you buy the take that he was clowning the Emilia Perez people?
Oh, yeah. He seemed to throw a little dart there at the end their way. Like you were saying, they're French. So I don't think they cared one way or the other.
They didn't care. But I found it, again, it's like I found it encouraging that a person like that making music of that nature, you know, reminds me a little of the Sufjan performing at the Oscars moment. Obviously, Sufjan didn't win, but it's like the absolute disconnect.
Or Elliot what that Smith. Person is.
Elliot Smith, yeah.
Back in the day.
What those people are doing in that setting. And I think that speaks to your larger point about this year's Oscars, which is like all of the acclaim pretty much outside of like the technical wins for Dune 2, all of the acclaim going to films and filmmakers and creative people who do not seem terribly engaged with the large project of what Hollywood is trying to be. That even trickles down to the snippet of Ramel Ross on the red carpet being like, I need $10 million to make my next two movies.
The director of Nickel Boy's a Best Picture nominee. Yeah.
Which is an absurd thing to have to beg for in public, number one. But number two, $10 million, literally a rounding error for most Hollywood studios. That said, we could also use $10 million if anybody sees fit.
Yeah, are podcasts a better investment than feature films in 2025? Maybe.
Could happen.
All right. So before we go, let's just do a little lightning round of other moments, musical or not, music adjacent or not, from last night's Oscars. I'll go first. That Conan O'Brien joke where he said, we're halfway through the show, which means it's time for Kendrick Lamar to come out and call Drake a pedophile, which I thought was a really funny joke. And I think is being roundly misunderstood to be another shot at Drake, which...
Oh, I didn't take any of that misunderstanding literally, I guess.
I know. And look, no one needs to hear us dissect Drake and Kendrick again. But if anything, I thought that the butt of the joke was just how relentless the promotion of that song has been in the past few weeks.
Yes.
You know.
You saw the writer of that joke or the person who said he wrote that joke on Twitter, like swatting away misunderstandings. But yeah, it seems to be like a reference to the ubiquity and the persistence of that song more than an insult of Drake specifically.
And the bizarreness, of course, of the subject matter.
And yeah, in the context of it appearing in a totally unrelated scenario.
Yeah, I thought, you know, Conan had his ups and downs, but I thought the highs were really high. And I'll take him any day over any combination of Trevor Noah, Jimmy Kimmel, Ricky Gervais, you know, the bench.
What about Tina and Amy?
Tina and Amy, obviously, always a good time. No issues there whenever they're ready to come back. What else stuck out to you about last night?
Mick Jagger.
Bob Dylan stand-in.
Delivering a bit. Not simply Mick Jagger showing up, but Mick Jagger being game to deliver a bit. I don't know if he had to be talked into it. I don't know if he often dogs himself out in casual conversation. I have no idea. But I liked seeing Mick Jagger... really in any context that was not on the road, fronting a contemporary version of the band, playing hits from 45 to 65 years ago.
It's easy to forget that it's Mick Jagger. Like Mick Jagger. Mick freaking Jagger. Like he's like the most charming, coolest dude ever. Like he's just up there holding it down in a way that only Mick Jagger could do. And you take people like that for granted sometimes. So it was nice to see him, like you're saying, a little bit out of context as a reminder. That's Mick Jagger.
Yes. All right. What else for you?
Oh, that's how I felt about seeing Benny Blanco as well, you know, in a room like that. I'm like, yep, that's Benny Blanco being the best wife guy in popular music.
Speaking of great partners, Kylie holding it together for Timmy on having, unfortunately, a swing and a miss last night. We've talked about the Timothée Chalamet Oscars campaign, and then everybody else was talking about the Timothée Chalamet Oscars campaign. First of all, I do want to say I saw some quibbles with Timmy's suit.
Bad color. Come on.
I could not disagree with you more. I thought it was an incredibly savvy and special look. The idea of him sitting in like the front corner seat, absolutely standing out and being individual from everybody behind him. That was a correct choice. Was it a shade too close to Brat Green? It probably was a shade too close to that. I would have loved it maybe even a tiny bit more on the yellow side. But generally speaking, I like that he's wearing slim fit. It's cut well to him, but because the material's leather, it has a little bit of softness and give. I really do think the outfits of the last 2 months have been, I'm very excited for where he's going sartorially. Kylie really holding it together. You can tell, I say this affectionately about Kylie, a person who's been on camera since she was like 6 years old. You can tell she doesn't love being on camera in these particular scenarios. And it's not because she's not the center of attention. Maybe it's because she's not in control. But it's, I think, I don't know if it feels like just slightly out of her reach or hasn't quite figured out what role am I playing here? Like, how much am I, quote unquote, Kylie Jenner? How much am I, quote unquote, partner of Timothée Chalamet? Like, it just she never looks quite happy standing by his side, but I don't think it's because she does not have affection for Timothée Chalamet. I think it's actually because she does, but doesn't quite know how to visually express that in a way that will resonate in like the thousands of cameras that are on her at any given moment.
I did feel a little bit of a lack of Timmy last night. He was the butt of a lot of jokes. He's gone so hard in the last few weeks and months trying to win this award and talking about his pursuit of greatness. But no, I would have loved for him to do a little Dylan. Like, I thought his musical performances on Saturday Night Live recently were extremely convincing, even though I went in hugely skeptical to the idea that Timothée Chalamet needed to perform Bob Dylan songs. But I left thinking, like, that is the greatest talent show performance I've ever seen in my life. And I think the Oscars could have used a little of that.
That could have been an opener. Like, that could the only thing that could have replaced Wicked is the opener, I think, would have been that.
And I would have loved to see him win, if only to avoid that absolute train wreck of a speech by Adrian Brody. But then the more I thought about it, the more I thought, if Leo had to lose four times and not win until The Revenant, then Timmy, you put in a lot of work, but you got a lot more work to put in, my guy. So keep at it. The only other person who is still putting in work futilely in this case is Diane Warren, who is now 0-16 in the best original song category.
Okay, quick, without thinking, what movie was her song for this year?
No idea. And to the point, no idea.
No idea.
But to the point where I think she needs to take a break, because she has not written a deserving song since I Don't Want to Miss a Thing in 1998. How Do I Live from Con Air was the year before that. Because You Loved Me from Up Close and Personal, Celine Dion, 96 before that. Any of those three could have won. Anything since then is just might as well not exist. Look, people don't like being forced to vote for somebody just because they think they deserve an award. Diane Warren, back to the lab, take a beat, find a movie that speaks to you and write a banger, and then maybe you can win.
I don't know much about the people who vote for best original song at the Oscar. You know, I'm not sure what they're looking for, but I would imagine, number one, they're looking for a song that they've heard in a movie that they've seen.
For a movie that exists. Yeah.
Right. So there's that. But also, I do think that Diane Warren, and this is actually a lesson for all creative people, writers, podcasters, whatever it might be. If you are coloring in within the outlines that have been prescribed to you for a particular task, it will always be clear that where the boundaries of those of that task are. And perhaps it might be an instructive exercise to work without those boundaries. And so if you wake up every morning being like, how am I going to write a song that is going to get nominated for best song at the Oscars in hopes that I may one day win? My feeling is that is a losing battle and one should stop fighting it. Should we go out with some Timmy playing Dylan on SNL?
Yeah, why not?
Which one should we do?
Let's do the rock and roll one. Let's hear Timothée Chalamet and band playing Outlaw Blues by Bob Dylan.
That's our show. Thank you to the powerful ladies of the Lead Company. Every podcast ever is at nytimes.com/podcast. Check us out on YouTube at youtube.com/podcast, on Instagram and TikTok at Podcast or Podcast Deluxe. We're in flux. You'll find us. You know what we look like. Go find us there. We will be back next week. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We're out.
Rest in peace, Michelle Trachtenberg.
Real talk.